Welcome to the American Shoulder and Elbow Surgeons Podcast. I'm your host, Peter Chalmers, a shoulder and elbow surgeon at the University of Utah in Salt Lake City, and I'm joined today by my co-host, Rachel Frank, a sports and shoulder surgeon at the University of Colorado in Denver. Rachel, how are you?
Pete, I'm doing terrific. How are you today?
Oh, I'm doing great. I'm glad to have you with me. Before we get started, I should mention the views expressed in this podcast do not necessarily reflect the views of the American Shoulder and Elbow Surgeons Society, the University of Utah, the University of Colorado, or the institutions of any of our guests. Today, we have a very interesting episode for you on what is an increasingly common situation for early career surgeons and is even becoming more common for seasoned surgeons. And that's the topic of changing a job. And changing a job anytime can be a daunting task. And there's no one better to talk about it with this than the one, the only, Dr. Evan Lederman from Phoenix, Arizona. Dr. Lederman is the chief of sports medicine at Baylor Health in Arizona. He's a clinical professor in the Department of Orthopedic Surgery at University of Arizona College of Medicine, Phoenix. He's the head team physician for the Phoenix Suns. He's an expert, a thought leader in all things shoulder surgery. Evan, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Peter, and thank you, Rachel. It's absolutely my pleasure to be here with you guys.
So tell us a little bit about your background. You know, where did you grow up, medical school, residency, fellowship? Where did you do your training?
I grew up in Los Angeles. I went to UCSB, the greatest college in the world, for undergrad, and then had the fortune of moving to the Midwest for 10 years, to the Medical College of Wisconsin in Milwaukee for residency and or medical school residency, which was quite a challenge, having grown up in LA. And then I was very fortunate to get a fellowship in Birmingham, Alabama, at the American Sports Medicine Institute. I was primarily under Larry Limack. But at that point, it was Jimmy Andrews and Bill Clancy ran the program. We had 9 fellows when we were there from all over the country. And then at the time when I was looking for a job, it was in the middle of the Clinton presidency, in the beginning of the HMO, and the beginning of a change in healthcare where jobs were a little challenging to find. I was fortunate to find a job in Phoenix, Arizona. With a group that had just signed their first capitated contract for Cigna Healthcare. And they hired myself and another gentleman named Kishore Tipranini to basically be the workhorses of the capitated healthcare system that they chose to join. And that was my beginning in Phoenix. I spent 2 years in that practice and decided it wasn't for me. I wanted to develop a sports practice and join a well-established group called the Orthopedic Clinic Association, which just had its 78th anniversary. And was a member of that clinic. I was hired by Tom Carter and was there until I moved to Baylor Health at the University of Arizona November 2019, right about the time COVID hit.
All right, lots to discuss with this, but in particular, I think the last thing that you mentioned. So you've changed jobs more than once, and I'm certainly curious about the early job change, but I think probably more interesting right now is your recent change to Banner, not only during the era of COVID, which creates a whole set of circumstances that create unpredictability, but why'd you decide to make that move? What drove it? And we'll get into some of the nuances here and some of the details, but yeah, what drove the decision-making?
Well, with the changes that have been going on in private practice healthcare, with acquisitions by hospital systems and purchasing by private equity, I think it makes everybody who's been in practice for a while really look at what they're doing and what they want to do and what their opportunities are. And I don't think in the past people did that as much because practices were more stable. The financial pressures weren't there. They were much more predictable. And we were a medium-sized practice of about 20 physicians. And came under some financial pressures, which made all of us look for different options. And I am faculty for the residency for the University of Arizona College of Medicine Phoenix residency program. And I was a private practice participant in it. And Baylor Health decided to expand its employed physician model to bring the majority of the educators in-house rather than use primary care. They wanted to build out a sports medicine program. So they basically presented me with an offer I couldn't refuse to build a sports medicine program. We've been trying to do this at my practice, TOCA, with the different health systems in town over the years, but really nobody was biting. And this opportunity presented itself, which created the ability to go and become a full-time educator with the residency program at Baylor Health.
The way that you tell a story, and I just want to make sure I understand it correctly, is that you were already, you know, you were in essentially a private practice, but you were working with this academic organization. And then when the opportunity, when things financially, then all of a sudden you had another option. You had a, not an escape plan, but you had another group of people that knew you and knew how great you were. Is that basically how you think you made the transition there?
That was a big part of it. And I like your term escape plan, you know, and when I was early in practice, one of my senior partners suggested that I get involved in management of practices as well as the leadership of the hospitals. And the whole idea was to create knowledge and opportunity to beef up your CV such that if you ever needed to do more administrative work or something like that, you would have the background to be able to do it. And that proved to be quite valuable when it came to transitioning, because as you become a little bit older, you can't do as much surgery necessarily. They need administrative leaders. So developing that knowledge base is important. I served as on the board of two hospitals and two surgery centers and a variety of different hospital appointments, as well as being the managing partner for 13 years of my practice. So that helped me learn a lot of the business side of medicine, which also gave me the ability to see when things were starting to become a problem. And it became a very easy transition into big healthcare, having been involved on the leadership side of things as well. So that's extra stuff we're asked to do sometimes. And I highly recommend that everybody get involved in leadership in whatever organizations they do. But you know, you guys are highly involved nationally, but locally is very important for your job.
So that story that, you know, you had, you did this kind of thankless work of managing the practice that probably didn't pay anything, that was probably extra meetings and extra time, but that it paid off only in the very long run, basically.
Yeah, it's definitely a long play. Most practices do pay their managing partners a small token fee, you know, that doesn't cover your time, but it makes you feel a little bit appreciated. But really understanding business healthcare helps. Leadership training, if you can get it, helps as well, especially when you start dealing with health systems. So now that everybody is dealing with some type of health system, because private practice model is really suffering in today's environment, being able to understand how they think is important and can create opportunity. And I was just very lucky to be able to find an opportunity in my own community. So I didn't have to reestablish a practice. And that's unique. Most people leave town when they go to new jobs. I was able to find a different position in the same city both times.
I think this is really an interesting topic. You know, we had our private equity episode, and we heard a lot about the pressures that are on small private practices and the ways in which those are kind of, those financial models are becoming increasingly difficult to sustain. Evan, what do you think are the larger trends that are driving that change? Are those trends staffing costs? Are those trends insurance reimbursement? Are those trends the switch to an EMR? Are those trends regulatory? What are the larger forces that are driving that change in your mind?
Well, Peter, you hit on all of them. You know, it started with the EMR. The EMR was the first major financial hit we took. We had to invest $1 million for an EMR, 12, 13 years ago. And that expense doesn't go away. There's yearly maintenance fees and there's hardware replacement and all that. And then the staffing costs started creeping up quite a bit, as well as the benefits costs. Health insurance has doubled, as you guys know. When you're in academic practice, you're a little protected from some of those business decisions. The rent goes up 3% per year, every year, forever. It never goes down. And our reimbursements don't go up. They are going down. So there's a convergence of profit and overhead over time. And the only way to stay successful is to grow. But you can only grow so much. We have limited access to capital. And every practice will get squeezed eventually. It's just a matter of how long they can make it for. And you know, you really only concern yourself with your career over a 30-year range. But some of these old legacy practices have had some real challenges, you know, maintaining their private practice existence over time. The ability to get some cash influx and some professional business leaders on private equity or from hospital acquisition has been huge. I mean, the trend has been tremendous with that. Or there's been the mega group formation to share overhead. But that doesn't always seem to work out so well. A number of those groups are under pressure as well.
One of the unique things about your move, and you mentioned this already, was you're in the same community. Can you talk to us, and this doesn't have to be specific to your contracts at the old and new place, but talk to us about non-competes in 2024. I think there's a lot of discussion on this in a lot of medical forums, not specific to shoulder surgery or orthopedic surgery, but specific to physicians in general, and some of the challenges with the idea of non-competes. I'm not going to get into my personal feelings about this, but I think we all probably share the same opinion about non-competes and how they benefit kind of the hospitals and never benefit patients and certainly never benefit us. And so how enforceable are they? Did that come into play? Should new grads worry about this if they're just trying to take the first job they can in a community that they want to be in, but they know it's not their dream job? Talk to us about non-competes when you're switching jobs within the same area.
Well, I mean, this is a legal issue, and legal issues tend to be local, and there tends to be history. We've had a lot of litigation on no-compete clauses in Arizona, and it's gone the way of unenforceable, and it's gone enforceable. But if you're a physician and you're leaving a practice and you signed a no-compete clause, the only way to get out of that is to litigate it or negotiate it. And that will be very costly, especially with the bigger groups, particularly the ones that are owned by private equity or hospital systems. They have unlimited legal resources to make it difficult for you. So while you may win, you may not really win in the long term, and nobody wins in a lawsuit. And the idea is you want to practice day one. You don't want to wait for someone to litigate for 2 years. So I think you need to be really careful of what you sign. If it's a great place to work, then you don't need the no-compete clause. We didn't have much of a no-compete clause in our practice at TOCA. You just couldn't set up your office basically next door. You could work at all the hospitals. But we have some no-compete clauses in Arizona that are 25-mile radiuses, which basically throws you out of town. And while you may win, and there may be ethical issues, and certainly the federal government has taken up this issue, right now you need to pay attention to what it says. And I think as any contract you sign, the number one thing you need to look at in any contract you sign is the exit language. How do I get out? And that's more important. That's the first thing you should look at. And if you can't get out the way you want to get out, that contract's a problem. The pay is the second thing you want to look at. Exit language is number one.
All right, we're going to get into some of those details too. One thing I'd love to ask you about is conceptually, what did you think was going to be the biggest challenge for you moving to the new gig? And what actually has been the biggest challenge for you? And on the flip side, what were you most looking forward to? And is that what's really happened? Or are there other benefits you didn't even see coming that you're excited about? So first kind of the negative and then the positive. What were you thinking was going to be the worst or the biggest challenge, and what actually has become the biggest challenge?
So my opportunity may be a little unique. I was hired to build a program that didn't exist. So I was given the opportunity to build out a sports medicine facility, 100,000-foot facility dedicated to our department, and they had already approved it. So some circumstances, you approach a healthcare system, you want to build something. Other times they've already approved it and they hire someone to do it. So I fell into the latter, which made that aspect of it a lot easier. But when you're dealing with, whether it's a healthcare system or a private equity system, there's a hierarchy of business people, administrators, and corporate folks whose job is the business, and they believe your job is to be the doctor. So there's a barrier of you trying to get involved on the business side when it's their job to do the business side. They don't want you in their world, and we don't want them in our world. So finding those boundaries was a little challenging. Wasn't planning on this, but I will pitch the Harvard Surgical Leadership Program, which I attended in its second year. And that was like giving the playbook to the opposing team. And everything I learned there gave me the tools I needed to communicate with these people, to put together the SBARs to be able to get things done. And we were just given the playbook of how to make something happen, how to affect change, how to raise money, how to get them to do stuff. So leadership training is important if you're going to deal with a system. You guys are in systems with huge hierarchy that have been around a long time. I'm sure you've seen this. And you can't do anything without permission. Fortunately, I don't have to go to my chairman or anyone in my program to get permission before I go to the administrator. So being able to get directly to the administrators is very helpful. The challenge is really come down to money. Money is the answer. It doesn't matter what the question is. And if you're going to get anything done, you need some money to do it, whether it's, you know, staff, equipment, it all comes down to money. So you got to be able to play their game to get what you need.
Okay, so now it sounds like when you moved because you had this phenomenal new opportunity. Do you think that there's a difference with that situation versus if you're moving because you just need to get out of your current job? How does that, you know, people I know are in both situations. Do you think that those are different, or do you think that as long as the jobs you're going to don't necessarily know that, that this position is the same?
I think it is a little different, Peter. If you're comfortable in your current job, that gives you negotiating power. If you're desperate because you're in a terrible situation, or, you know, God forbid, you've been terminated or fired or furloughed, you've lost all your negotiating power. And then you also have a timing issue too, because you need to, you know, get back on the income stream if you don't have, you know, revenue coming in. So you always want to negotiate from a position of power, and it is a negotiation. Anytime you're taking a new job, for the most part, some are a lot easier than others, and it also depends on what you want. I mean, the goal of moving into a position is that the grass is supposed to be greener where you're going. It isn't always. And you need to know what you're getting into. And as Rachel mentioned earlier, knowing what the barriers are to entry. And the more information you have, the better. So always be in a position of negotiating power by not being in a desperate situation.
So there's a lot of docs I know that are 5+ years, 10+ years, even 20+ years into careers, and they're not happy. They want to move, but they're settled and they have their referral patterns. They have their routines. They have their staff, their family, their kids, everything's settled. So how do you know when it's the right time? Obviously there are, you know, maybe not in your specific situation because you had some very, very specific reasons. But there, you know, there's always some situations where you have to move. It's a toxic environment. You signed and you didn't know what you were doing, especially for the younger grads who don't know what they don't know. I mean, I certainly was someone who didn't know what I didn't know, and you learn as you go. But how do you know when you're not hating it, you don't dread going to work, but you're not loving it as much as you used to, and perhaps a change of environment could be the very thing that helps you. How do you know? How do we advise surgeons to give it a legit look? And I'm sure you're thinking of the same surgeons I am, where there's many who have made recent career moves in the last 2 to 5 years, and it's not that they were unhappy, but they weren't quite happy and decided on a change. How do you know?
It's difficult. It's like any relationship. Until you're married to the person, you just don't always know everything you want to know. So you got to do your homework. You got to talk to people. You know, partnership is personal. You need, you know, hopefully you're going to work with honest people that are trustworthy and do what they say they're going to do, that, you know, the financial deal is fair. You know, I think a couple things, if you're looking at a job, so let's take private practice, which is a little different than academic. If you're looking at a private practice move, you need to know the financials of the business. And if they won't show you their financials, that's a red flag. So, and you need to understand what the financials are. You know, they're not going to send all their books to your home to review with your accounts. So you need to get some information to determine that they are in good shape and that they're not, you know, getting ready to go bankrupt and they're grabbing at straws by hiring a couple guys. That can happen. You know, you should look at what the revolving door of partnerships being where you go. How many people leave after 2 years and how many people stay, how many people make partner. And then you need to look at the partnership deal. The groups that have large buyouts for retiring partners are always a little bit of a red flag, because someone has to pay that bill in the end, and it tends to be the younger people. And if you got 20 guys older than you that are going to retire, someone's going to be paying them off. So you need to look at the circumstances of buy-in and buy-out. I think buy-out's almost more important than buy-in. If you have a huge buy-in, that's going to somebody. Now, there has to be fair market issues with regards to staying out of trouble with Stark and things like that. particularly depending on who owns the centers and whether they participate in Medicare, that kind of stuff. So you got to do your homework. You got to understand the business of medicine a little bit. Now, academically, the financial pressures are different. Okay. So you're not, you're joining a huge business. Their financials are public. You need to understand the culture of your department. Academic advancement is important. Research funds, personnel, something simple as just getting surgical assistance in the operating room, you know, and what your obligations are for teaching, whether you have issues with regard to consulting or any other conflict of interest that may occur. You need to know if you are inventive and you're thinking of trying to invent something and creating a royalty product, you need to know what the rules are of the institution you're going into. So knowledge is power, and you got to talk to a lot of people and, you know, use attorneys to look at your documents. But best thing is talk to people who have done it at all ages, and people are happy to talk to you. I talk to young surgeons all the time who are looking to relocate here or switch practices within the community. And, you know, hopefully they learn something from those conversations.
All right, let me follow up on that. What do people more senior need to really negotiate for when they're switching jobs compared to when you're early in practice? So when it's your first job coming out of fellowship, you're going to really prioritize item A, B, and C in your job negotiations. But when you've been in practice for as long as you have been, you know what's important. You know what's important to you, which may not be important to another surgeon. You know what makes your practice work. So what are the differences in the key things people might negotiate for at an earlier stage in their practice and jobs versus a later one?
So if you're going into practice, you need to know where your revenue is coming from and how much of it's from ancillary revenue, how much of it is from what you earn, what their contracts are, and in a new practice, how you're going to replace that. So for instance, if it's 2 years to vest into an ancillary revenue stream, that may have a significant impact on your earning, particularly if the ancillary revenue is a third or a half of a partner's income. So looking at that's important. You also may have no competes from where you're leaving. If you're leaving one surgery center and going to another across town, you may be no competed out of that for a couple of years. So that can affect that as well. So you need to understand that part. Again, looking at entrance and exit language and buy-ins is important and how they're going to do that. But you also need to secure your personnel. Don't assume they're going to hire you a medical assistant, a surgery scheduler, a PA, and how it's all going to get paid for right away. You need to negotiate every one of those people. Research assistant, if you're doing research, and adequate personnel to be able to do your practice, because none of us can practice by ourselves. We need help, and you need to make sure you're given that help. And that you have to negotiate up front. If you're going in academics, then research funding, research personnel, dedicated time to be able to teach, to travel, teach locally, teach outside of your community. That's all negotiated ahead of time.
You know, your situation is unique because you were within the same community. So you had established referral patterns. You had a great reputation in Phoenix. You could move from one place to another and preserve a lot of those referral patterns. Maybe not all of them, but a lot of them. What I think is really interesting is if you're moving to a new community, we have to establish new referral patterns. So you're essentially giving up, you know, your established practice. How do you decide if that's the right move? How do you evaluate, and this is, I guess, specific, the nuts and bolts of my question. How do you look at a new opportunity and evaluate it and say, once this is up and rolling, it's going to be better than my current opportunity, and it's also worth the growth period I would have to go to get to that up and rolling? How do you make that decision, Evan? What do you think?
Well, it's challenging. And your reputation from a national level may go with you, but all politics are local and healthcare is local. And you develop your referral base through the experience the community's had with you. Your biggest referral is your patients and word of mouth over time. And then there's the primary care network and other physicians that get to know you over time. Those relationships take time, and it doesn't travel with you, unfortunately, because the community you're moving into has no idea who you are. And even if you have a huge reputation and you've been in practice 20 years and you've done 800 surgeries a year, it's all zero when you get to the new community. And you may get, you'll get some people will know who you are and refer patients, but you don't have the community awareness. So you're going to take a big hit for a while. Academics, it may be a little bit better because you have the healthcare system that's going to feed you. And your reputation carries a little bit where you go. But, you know, when it comes to other specialties, they don't really know who we are. You know, they may be familiar with the name, but they don't follow us like we follow us in our own specialty. So that you need to be prepared for. And when you move to a new community, it takes 3 to 5 years for people to know you're there, even if you have a big reputation. So in an academic environment where you're salaried or guaranteed, it's not as much of a problem. But in private practice, and people don't move communities in private practice, they don't jump jobs as much unless it's a family situation or they want to go to a different area. Whereas in academics, people move a lot because they're trying to move up the academic ladder.
So one of the things that you said in the middle there that I think is really important for people to hear is that it takes 3 to 5 years for people to know that you are someplace. And I think what you're saying is totally true, that we, you know, within some specialties, you know, people become well known, but that to the larger community, no one has any idea who we are. So the question I have for you is, you know, you said a lot of people are salaried for 2 years. You know, if you are in a situation where your practice is really rolling, is that long enough? Is it better to negotiate for more money early on or for a longer tail, figuring it's going to take you a long time to build? Is that a personal decision, or do you think there's a right or a wrong way to look at that particular aspect of it, by which I mean the pay and the salary and when you kind of come off salary into more production model?
So there's not a simple answer to it. It depends on the individual physician and how aggressive that they are going at and getting business. Some people are a little more passive. Some people are very aggressive at doing it. It depends on what your base pay is going to be on a guarantee. If they'll give you a pretty good base pay, take the guarantee, take the pressure off, establish yourself in your community, have time to be able to go and create relationships, you know, give lectures, not be really so focused on productivity so early, because it does take time. Now, if you have a well-established practice and you're not learning how to practice, you probably get to a point where you're profitable in a RVU, eat what you kill model within 2 years. But if you're young and you're still learning the practice of medicine, it takes longer, and a longer guarantee can be better for you and take a lot of pressure off on building your practice and allow you to really work on your method and your patient care to develop the reputation that you want. And the speed and the ability to do more surgeries comes later.
So one thing I wonder about when we think about moving jobs later in life is you're setting your practice and your skill set, right? You've been doing shoulder arthroplasties, proximal humerus fractures, cuffs, instability for 20 years. That's what you do. That's what you want to do. You've gotten to be senior in your group or your practice, and maybe you don't take call anymore. And you go to a new practice where now you have to take call, either due to group policy or that's how you want to build your practice locally in your community. Should that worry someone who's more senior in their career if they haven't replaced a hip or put on an X-fix in 15, 20 years? Should that be a deterrent? Things like call. What if you're used to having a PA and that's not going to be part of the new job early on, and you're not used to, say, you're a sports surgeon and you're doing ACLs and you're not used to prepping your grafts, and now maybe you're going to have to, and that's going to slow you down. Are those little things, can they be big enough to deter someone from wanting to switch a job?
Absolutely. Just even my own personal experience, when I moved to this health system, I was the only employed sports medicine doctor at the university. And I've had a practice where I did a lot of knee surgery, but not so much in the last few years. And I had to take on all the knee surgery, all the sports knee, until I hired Tom Carter to come and take it all over from me. And I did not have to worry about call, but many people do. And again, that's all things you negotiate in there. You need to know what you're walking into, and you need to have the ability to do that. I mean, jumping back into call after not being in it for a period of time can be a real problem and can create some liability for yourself and for the health system. So you need to know what your practice is going to be and what's expected of you. And many people are prepared to do general orthopedics and take all that stuff and are happy to do it. But some people have developed very specialized practices, and they know who they are. You get busier if you do everything faster. So you got more cases to do, particularly if you take call in a new community. But these are all things you need to understand about any new job that you take.
Evan, this has been just an amazing, like, this is, there's an amazing wealth of information you've just shared with us. What have we not asked? You know, Rachel and I are still relatively young in our careers. I'm sure there's a lot of aspects to this we haven't gotten to. What are the things that we're missing that you think listeners need to know about when they think about changing jobs?
So I think you need to be very introspective on why you want to change and what, why you're changing, what's important to you, whether it's community, family, the socialization of the community you're in. You know, is it truly that you don't like your practice or that you feel unsupported or that there's a ceiling of advancement that you can't get through? Or there's too many people there. And you need to understand why you're leaving, and you need to decide if the program you're going to join is going to give it to you. And the programs that you look at, particularly you guys going in academics, you know, a lot of the very well-known programs have, you know, a very set program for advancement, a very set protocol how to do things, and some smaller programs give you a lot more mobility and creativity. So it's important to understand who you are, what your practice is, and be honest with yourself and see if that other practice can get you there. The grass isn't always greener on the other side, and you've probably talked to many people who have made moves that they regretted or it didn't pan out the way it was. We all have a lot of the same problems everywhere we are, and in the end, work's kind of hard, and some days are bad, and it's not perfect all the time, and we have complications, we have difficult patients. You need to feel supported by the people around you. You need to be treated fairly. It has to be a good work environment where you feel valuable and the ability to get better, and that you trust your partners and you're happy sending friends and family to them as well. And if, you know, in trying to create that environment is important, but it really starts with understanding who you are and what you really want, and not what somebody else thinks you want or what people keep telling you to do because it's good for you.
I could not agree more with Pete. This has been an amazing bit of information and a lot of information in a short period of time. I think, you know, as Pete and I are relatively young in our careers, we think of a lot about these things from a much different lens than you have, and you have so much perspective, having gone through a couple different practice environments, but also you've hired, you know, folks at all different stages in their careers. You've talked to your colleagues who have made big moves. You know, one of Pete and my mentors made a big move late, Dr. Romeo late in his career, and we picked his brain on that. And so it's just amazing to hear your perspective. And I think for our listeners out there, both young and seasoned, I think it's important to know that it's possible to make change, and sometimes you don't know when it's going to happen, but certainly there's things to look out for as you're negotiating and as you're thinking about that next phase. I think the thing I take home the most is you always want to be running to something great, not running away from something terrible. So you want to take that next job, ideally, if you're taking one, because it's amazing. It offers you, like you said, an offer you can't refuse, you know, and that's, I think that's probably the best way to end up in a new job if you're looking to get a new job. So that's all the time we have for this podcast. We want to thank Dr. Evan Letterman so much for spending the time with us. And for all our shoulder and elbow listeners out there, please don't forget to subscribe. And for Pete Chalmers, I'm Rachel Frank, and we'll see you next time.